I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Ukraine crisis. Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian history emeritus. Minsk, too, is at the center of the disputes these last weeks and will continue. I welcome Steve to comment on the headlines about Minsk, too, that we've had just within the last 24, 48 hours and over the last week. Minsk, too, you will all recall, is the agreement mid-February arrived at by the four principals in the Ukraine civil war, Ukraine itself, Russia, France, and Germany. Nothing was signed by the leaders of state as they attended Minsk as the capital of Belarus. But since then, there has been evidence that everybody's proceeding towards a disengagement along the Donbass front and moving towards election decisions having to do with the federalizing of Ukraine, that is, giving independence to the Donbass region, especially Luhansk and Donetsk, the two cities that were most damaged in the fighting of the last year. However, there are doubts about Minsk II in all quarters, and I mentioned before Steve begins our conversation the doubts from different directions. Let's begin the doubts from the United States' direction. We have an article in the Atlantic Council website within these last days by Stephen Blank, a senior fellow for Russia at the American Foreign Policy Council. Mr. Blank argues that what is at stake is not Ukraine. It is not just a quarrel over the fate of Ukraine. I quote him. It is a war for the future of Russia and beyond that for the long-term future of European and Eurasian security. And to the extent that we hide behind rhetoric that masks a deeper inaction or complacency about Russia and Ukraine, we are only storing up for ourselves and future generations a larger continental crisis. You understand, it's not about Ukraine. It's about a continental crisis in the immediate future, says a distinguished voice for the Atlantic Council. At the same time, front pages of the New York Times in these last hours, the headline, Waving Cash, Putin Sows EU Divisions in an Effort to Break Sanctions. Steve will speak at length about this, but the New York Times was pointing to Cyprus and the prime minister in Cyprus and his relations with Russia, and also the prime minister of Greece on his way to Moscow in these next hours to talk to Mr. Putin, and the question of whether Mr. Putin is undermining the unanimity of the EU. Remember, we're coming up to the EU decision to continue or not the European Union sanctions on Russia for Ukraine crisis. I mention also that Donald Tusk, who was prime minister of Poland, certainly a state that is eager to prosecute the Ukraine war because it sees Russia as a threat along its frontier, is said to be in a difficult place because he's the head of the European Council. And so maintaining unanimity falls to his task, though he speaks with the language of the country, Poland, in the lead of worrying about Russia's aggression. Then Ukraine. Mr. Poroshenko himself making a speech saying that this call for federalization is a threat to his country. He's put together a constitutional council and he's calling for a referendum throughout the country. However, I note that the leader of the Donetsk People's Republic, Andrei Pergin, makes it very clear that none of his people nor none of the Donbass was invited to the constitutional convention. And this referendum, he calls into question whether it would have any validity because its results in the Donbass would be in question. And after all, the rest of the country voting against us is not to be trusted. Finally, and there are notes here about skirmishes along the Donbass region about around Mariupol, where their fighting was intense in February. I mention that because there's fighting routinely now reported on both sides. Finally, the doubts about Minsk II extend to Moscow. Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, in an interview says that the Minsk agreements are being blocked by Ukraine. He also mentions that everyone he hears from, all the foreign ministers, all the capitals of Europe, tell him that every instance they're getting pressure by the American ambassador in their country or by Washington itself, pressure to very much undermine Minsk II. So says Sergei Lavrov. Steve, a very good evening to you. It falls to you now to connect all these events. It looks like there's a campaign in the United States and in the European Council and in Kiev itself against Minsk II. Why, Steve? Why does Minsk II, which has after all brought this ceasefire, why does that threaten the United States, the European Union, or Kiev? Good evening to you.
Well, John, we've talked about Minsk too and its importance for maybe 3 weeks now since it was signed in February, but some of your folks may have come into the story late. So briefly, the meaning and significance of Minsk too. In February, Chancellor Merkel of Germany and President Hollande of France went to Minsk, the capital of Belarus, and agreed with Putin, the president of Russia, and Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, on a ceasefire on the front line of the Ukrainian civil war, generally in the area of the Donbas, where the pro-Russian elements are fighting against the armies of Kiev. They also agreed, in addition to the ceasefire, to a series of political agreements, which, if implemented, involving negotiation, would end the underlying Ukrainian civil war. So the importance of Minsk, to be dramatic, but I think it's a dramatic moment, is that those forces and people who want a negotiated settlement, which seems fair to me to both sides, are in favor of Minsk and are supporting it. And those who do not want a negotiated settlement, at least on these terms, who want to expand the war against the East, which may mean the war against Russia, are literally sabotaging the Minsk agreement. And you have both forces in Washington, in Kiev, and in Europe. The reason that Minsk is also important is it is a clarifying moment. We now know who is who. When academics, intellectuals, political leaders, officials, generals speak in any of these capitals, we know immediately whether they want a negotiated settlement or whether they want more war. And you quoted enough people in your introduction to our discussion that your listeners can tell who's who. Let me just say one other word about this before we go to the components. I've been thinking a lot lately about what the former late Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan once said, and it's very important. He said that everyone is entitled to his or her own opinion, but not to his or her own facts. And as we approach the possibility of war, it's really not opinion that matters, it's the facts. And the fact is that the Minsk Agreement may be the last chance to avoid an actual war with Russia. That's how important it is. And it's also a fact that people like Stephen Blank, whom you quoted at the Atlantic Council, and many of the statements coming out of the American Congress, which seems to be mostly a war party, and out of NATO, that these generalizations are not based on fact. They're based on their opinion. Now, again, as Moynihan said, they're entitled to their opinion, but not to the degree that their misstatement of fact is leading us to war. So Minsk is the barricade, and which side prevails may determine not only the future of European security, but whether or not we are going to end up in a war with Russia.
And Minsk, too, because it's a process and it's ongoing, it's being administered. It has inspectors on the ground, the OSCE, representing the Europeans. And while there are violations and there have been instances of deaths along the frontier, generally understood that the Minsk II ceasefire is holding. So what we're waiting for is the political process. Is that correct, Steve? That's where the pressure is on the political process.
It's very important that you said that, John, because as you emphasized indirectly, the basic criterion at the moment is humanistic. Are more or less people dying in that Ukrainian civil war? About 6,000, maybe many more, have already died. 1 million plus have fled into Russia or elsewhere as refugees. Many lie dying now in the rubble of the big cities of the Donbas. The answer factually is that since the ceasefire was declared in February, and since the Kiev army pulled back its heavy artillery, which had been pounding the capital cities of Donbas, that's Donetsk and Luhansk, said Luhansk in Ukrainian, many fewer people are dying. So the ceasefire, even though it's being violated episodically, probably by both sides, is a good, virtuous thing. Fewer people are dying, and the people who die are mostly women and children and old people. So you're right. The focus is political now. So let's go to what you mentioned at the top.
All right, we'll start there. Just a moment, Steve, when we come back, because we'll start the political about Mr. Putin waving cash and about what it means that there's a prime minister from Greece headed to Moscow. Steve Cohen, Professor Steve Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. We're discussing Ukraine crisis and cash. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen of New York University, Princeton University, Russian History Emeritus. We're discussing Minsk II, a political process ongoing for a Ukraine crisis. And there are those who oppose or look to be undermining Minsk II or have their doubts about Minsk II going forward. This also conjoins with concerns about the sanctions passed by the EU and by the United States against Russia for its conduct in Ukraine crisis. And within these last hours, a headline in the New York Times, waving cash, Putin sows EU divisions in an effort to break sanctions. Steve, this points to the Prime Minister of Greece, Alexis Tsipras, also to the Mr. Anastasiadis of Cyprus, both of whom in conversation, said to be in conversation with Mr. Putin. To what end? What is the allegation? And how does this connect to Minsk II?
Well, let's go back to the two New York Times stories. Today, Tuesday, the New York Times published three pieces about this crisis. It published a front-page news story about Greece and Cyprus turning to Russia for financial help. Then it published an editorial warning Greece to beware of Putin and not accept his financial help. And then it published a third story, a news story, about what the president of Ukraine said in regard to the political agreement at Minsk, which we can come to later. And the Times is a very important newspaper. It reflects establishment opinion and anxiety and concern. So when you get three stories, you know somebody's high up is worried. What's interesting about these stories regarding Putin in Europe, it omits two factors that I think any reader would kind of wonder about. First of all, how is it that Putin has any cash since we put these heavy sanctions on Russia, which were supposed to cripple him economically? It seems inconsistent with the story of the great success of the Western sanctions. I mean, Cyprus shares and Greece share to a certain extent Russia's Orthodox form of Christianity, Catholicism, Christianity. So there are strong cultural ties, but it's economics that's driving it. And that obscures the larger story. And this is the real point, and this is what the Times should be asking. Is American policy toward Russia and Ukraine destroying European unity? It's not Putin American policy has split Europe. That's why, after all, Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, and Hollande, President of France, flew in a kind of panic to Minsk because they thought American policy was leading to war, and they wanted to stop it. So you can see the split in Europe. It's not Putin who split Europe. It's American policy. But, of course, Putin is in a corner, politically, financially, economically. So he's looking for soft spots. He's looking for cleavages in Europe where he can reestablish working relations. And Greece and Cyprus are two such cases. But the Times lead is wrong. It's not that Putin's damaging European unity. It's the American leadership and the sanctions, which are hurting Europe as well, that are doing it. So what will come of this, it's not clear. But the reason that's important in the longer term is that this summer, the sanctions that were adopted a year ago against Russia, and nobody remembers exactly what they were targeted at. Later, they said it was the annexation of Crimea. Now they say it's the fighting in Donbass. But generally, it's dislike of Putin. But they come up for a vote, whether they're done or they're going to be renewed this summer. And it does appear increasingly that maybe up to, and it has to be unanimous, I think all 28.
Right, it does have to be unanimous, 28 members. And already Mr. Tsipras has said that the sanctions are a dead-end policy. Also,
well, so has the president of Hungary and Czechoslovakia. And obviously Merkel didn't fly to Minsk like that for her health. The sanctions are really hurting Germany, which is supposed to be the financial foundation of the European Union. There's talk in England about leaving the Eurozone. Greece may leave. There is, I wouldn't call it a crisis, but a kind of pre-crisis of the Eurozone unfolding. Now, it was financial until the Ukrainian crisis began, but now it's also political. Russia is needed, and the sanctions for economic prosperity in Europe need to be removed. So what we see going on with Greece and Cyprus today are a tip of a European iceberg of discontent. What Poroshenko did, of course, was a direct assault on the political agreements of Minsk.
I want to stay just a moment with Cyprus and Greece, because both countries have uncertain financial situations. Cyprus, of course, is out of money, and he's facing a deadline in June, which just coincidentally happens to be the same sanctions deadline. The president of Cyprus, Niko Anastasiadis — I said before he was prime minister, he's president. Mr. Cyprus is prime minister of Greece, different governances. He is, in addition, offended by actions of the Obama administration. And I want to mention this, Steve, because we'll come back to this with Lavrov saying there's a lot of pressure coming from Washington and from ambassadors. Apparently, the U.S. ambassador to Cyprus — this is in the New York Times story — tried to suggest that Mr. Anastasiadis was visiting Moscow in some relation to Boris Nemtsov's killing in Moscow, the opposition politician. Anastasiadis was extremely offended by this, and John Koenig, the ambassador, has apologized to this. But here's an indication of the ambassadors or the State Department confusing U.S. policy with what we'd have to say Ukraine crisis. And it's all being wrapped up into what looks like a campaign out of Washington, Steve, to put pressure on the weak parts of Europe.
I think it's more profound than that. By definition, an ambassador is a diplomat, not a information warrior. Not a proponent of war, but a proponent of diplomacy and negotiations. What the ambassador to Cyprus said about the leader of Cyprus, that somehow he was implicated in the murder of the Russian oppositionist Boris Nemtsov by lending authority to Putin with his visit, is loathsome. First of all, there's no evidence or logic that Putin was behind this killing. Secondly, it's disgraceful that an American ambassador would imply such a thing about the leader of a country to which he's assigned. But he's not an isolated case. You recall just recently, maybe you brought it to my attention, John, that the president of Czechoslovakia intended to go to the 70th anniversary of World War II, the end of World War II in Moscow in May, was threatened by the American ambassador to Czechoslovakia.
Let's speak more of this pressure when we come back. Professor Stephen Cohen. Professor Stephen F. Cohen of Russian History of Princeton University, NYU. Forgive me, Steve. We'll be right back. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen will forgive me for interrupting him before. He was making an excellent observation about pressure by U.S. ambassadors to heads of state in Europe. These states are participating in the EU sanctions against Russia. So why is it that suddenly we have an outbreak of undiplomatic behavior? We've mentioned Mr. Anastasiadis, who's the president of Cyprus, who was visiting Moscow, and the American ambassador, John Koenig, in some fashion on social media, on Twitter, for the world to see, suggested there was a link between Mr. Anastasiadis' visit to Moscow and the Nemtsov killing of a prominent politician, or a prominent Russian opposition politician. Steve then flags, within these last days, the surprising development in the Czech Republic. The Prague Castle, it's a part of the ceremonial governance of the Czech Republic of Czechoslovakia. It's also very famous in American history for what happened there in the 20th century. However, the American ambassador and the Czech president have now fallen out over a suggestion that there's some Steve, that the American ambassador was implying that the Czech Republic was working hand in glove with Moscow, as if he'd sold out.
Well, he said that if the Czech ambassador or the Czech president went to the ceremony — and this is an enormous event for Russia and for the whole of Europe.
This is the VE Day celebration for the victory over the Great Patriotic War.
On May 9th, it's the most sacred Russian holiday, and it's the 70th anniversary. And whether you like it or not, the Soviet Red Army was the main liberating anti-Nazi force in Europe. We came to Europe only in June 1944. Russians had been fighting on the Eastern Front since 1941. Whether the Red Army later became an occupying army is a different question. But they played the role of liberating Europe from that part of Europe from the Nazis. So the Czech Republic, president, rightfully, and I think normally, morally, I said he was going to go to the ceremony, though Obama has refused to go. And apparently, the American ambassador told him there would be unpleasantries for Czechoslovakia if he did, threatening him. But there's more. It is said in Kiev, and I think probably, if not completely true, significantly true, that the real president of Kiev is not Poroshenko, but the American ambassador there, John Piatt. In other words, the State Department and its proconsuls, our ambassadors, a very distinguished profession, are not doing what they're supposed to be doing, preventing war, but they are acting as pro-warfare proconsuls. And to me, this suggests the way the Ukrainian crisis has unleashed a kind of poisonous degradation in our political culture generally. I hate to mention it, but to give you an example, because it happened to me last night, and I'm just reeling from it, partly due to my broadcast with you, not only, also to my writings, a very eminent academic in Canada, the head of a Ukrainian studies institute, a big one, the University of Alberta, had occasion to say that I, Stephen Cohen, because of what I had said about American policy and Russian policy and Ukraine, was of lower moral stature than a Ukrainian. He had a man in mind for various reasons, whom archives show was a Nazi collaborator, a Jew killer in Ukraine. And he wrote, I had less moral stature than this man. This has, there are no more bottom lines. So if this kind of discourse can take place in academic circles, if American ambassadors can behave the way they're behaving, something has gone profoundly wrong. And after all, John Kerry, the Secretary of State, who is the boss of the State Department, who is the boss of these ambassadors, could put a stop to it with one classified email to all ambassadors. But he hasn't. And when the Russians encounter Lavrov, Kerry, as you indicated in your introduction, they're not sure where Kerry is. But I worry not only about the crisis that may lead to war with Russia, but I worry even more that the people in power are abetting it, not trying to prevent it. Though it does appear that Obama has gotten worried and backed off, but he too's under siege now.
In Kiev, Mr. Poroshenko, Petro Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, is speaking of a referendum, perhaps later this year. It wasn't necessarily encased in the Minsk II, but this would be a positive step forward. Strikingly, this is Mr. Poroshenko's quote, I would like very much and believe it is possible for the commission, this is a constitutional commission, to become a unifying platform of all political forces, society, domestic and international experts, in working out such important constitutional initiatives required by our society. He's looking to a referendum in all of Ukraine later on this year, perhaps by the end of 2015, to vote on the idea of federalization. At the same time, he denounces federalization. Why is he doing this, Steve? How does this help his case, given Minsk II?
Well, I think we have to begin by saying that Poroshenko is a very weak president of Ukraine. And maybe we don't fault him for that, that there are other forces in Ukraine, particularly the prime minister, Yatsenyuk, who have Washington's full backing and who are sabotaging Poroshenko. I think it's also the case that Poroshenko is not a very experienced or clever politician, because what he said gutted the political agreements reached in Minsk, which Poroshenko himself agreed to. Generally speaking, after the ceasefire, both sides agreed that Kiev, which Poroshenko heads, would begin to talk with the representatives of the Donbas, the political representatives. A dialogue would begin. Poroshenko has formed a commission to enact the Minsk agreement by excluding all representatives of the Donbas.
Which just flabbergasted me when I learned that. There are no representatives from the separatists in the constitutional debate or in the negotiations.
That's correct. Two, the second thing he did was unilaterally announce that there could be no element of federalism. And federalism is just a word for meaning what we call states' rights. It means giving localities enough political autonomous authority that they can elect, for example, their own governors. They can pick their own police chiefs. They can pick their own governors of the educational system, whether it'll be done in Ukrainian or in Russian. By the way, he also said, violating a longstanding element of the Ukrainian constitution, there will be only one official language, Ukrainian, in Ukraine, not Russian, even though virtually everybody speaks Russian. Not everybody speaks Ukrainian, and there are large territories that are native Russian-speaking. You could not have a united Ukraine unless you allow Russian to be used officially in local affairs, in schools, in the post office, for driver's license, to get married, and the rest. This is going to be banned. This is what set off the rebellion in the East to begin with. But moreover, he said two other things. He said federalism is an infectious, disease-ridden form of government that destroys nations. Well, that will come as a surprise to the United States, Canada, Germany, and many other countries that have adopted federalism because of their size and their diversity. I would think that the presidents of these countries would be offended by what he said. That's why I say he's not a very deft politician. But then he revealed his hand. He said instead of talking with Donbass, he would have a referendum on the future constitution of Ukraine, whether it would be federalist or unitary or what it would be. But the nation is gerrymandered electorally, as we know from Poroshenko's own election and that of parliament. Essentially, the Southeast, which is Russian-speaking and sustained neutral or pro-Russian governments in Kiev for many years after the end of the Soviet Union, particularly the Donbass, are essentially either excluded from voting or they're boycotting the votes because they don't have candidates. They don't have representation. So you have in Kiev today what is essentially a president and a parliament elected by Western and Central Ukraine with very little representation by the Southern and Eastern territories that are along Russia's border. And that's what Poroshenko says he's going to do. That it, to this truncated Ukraine in the West and the center, that he's going to give permission via some referendum to decide the future of Ukraine. In a word, John, if he does that, and by the way, he's not doing it on his own. He's doing it with powerful backers in Washington. If he does that, if they go ahead with this folly, the result will be one of two. It will be a permanently partitioned Ukraine, that is two Ukraines, or it will be war.
And to that effect, I note that we're going to go to Lavrov next because he's given an interview in Moscow. Lavrov has noted that the President Poroshenko in Kiev is exploring what Lavrov calls a tactical loophole by inviting foreign troops, that would be U.S. troops, NATO troops, into Ukraine as training for a peacekeeping mission. I mention that, Steve, because you wanted to make sure everybody understood there is no longer a Ukrainian army and a National Guards force. They have been united, and the National Guards force are said to be the people that the U.S. is going in to train. The National Guards force evidenced no discipline whatsoever in the fighting last year and during the winter. This is the force that you point to all the time correctly as a product of the right sector, of the neo-fascist elements who march on the streets of Kiev.
I think Americans, and you have many, 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 many listeners, your listeners as Americans, need to make a decision about this. And I go back to Moynihan. You can have an opinion, but you can't have your own facts. The facts here are clear. I didn't make them up. They're reported, not by American media, but by international media almost every day, that the Ukrainian army, the official army, is in shatters. It would need a lot of repair to use the weapons that Congress wants to send to it, that the intact fighting forces are these battalions.
Right.
They grew out of right-wing, some say neo-fascist, and some are fascist and not neo, political forces who formed their own brigades, armed militia, then were formed into fighting battalions, and now have been gathered into what they call in Ukraine the National Guard. It's the National Guard, and this is a fact, we've been told this officially by NATO and the United States, that's going to receive training by boots on the ground Americans later this month and weapons. So an American has to ask him or herself, am I okay with my government, leave aside your tax money, with my government training to fight in the Ukrainian Civil War battalions that are strongly influenced by neo-fascist elements? That's a question that Americans now have to decide. Now, this came up in Congress, John, and the result was very sad. There have been, I believe, 4 congressional votes, and overwhelmingly, the Senate and the House voted to send these weapons. Well, maybe they don't know, but if they don't know, they should resign their position and go home because it's easily learned. On the other hand, 2 weeks ago Monday, I believe, I think it was the 23rd of March, was a Monday, the House voted again, and even though 500-plus overwhelmingly voted to send the weapons, 48 members of the House voted against it. They'd figured this out. But some Americans have connected these two dots, that these battalions do not represent American or Western views. We could talk about them at length sometime, because they've said what they think.
A tactical loophole is what Sergei Lavrov calls them, and that will be explored by them.
It's not rocket science. I mean, some of them wear swastikas on their helmets. They speak with admiration about Hitler.
There are lots of videos. You can go to the Kiev sites and see the videos. I'm speaking with Professor Stephen F. Cohen. We're going to turn to Sergei Lavrov and his interview with Rossiya Sigodnya within these last days, not just about the tactical loophole of the National Guards, but also about the pressure he hears being put on visitors to Moscow, important state visitors to Moscow, by the Secretary of State in particular, John Kerry. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Stephen F. Cohen is here, and we just have a few minutes, and so I wanted to go to this interview with Sergei Lavrov, published within these last hours with Rossiya Sigodnya. This is an interview in which Mr. Lavrov believes that Ukraine is seeking to undermine Minsk II. He says that the Normandy Four, that would be Russia, Germany, France, and Ukraine, have put together ways to monitor Minsk II and its products and its progress. However, Mr. Lavrov believes, as we've discussed, Ukraine is looking to undercut that. There's also this. This is the quote, Steve. All partners who I meet when paying visits and my colleagues who come with visits to Russia have come under pressure either from a U.S. ambassador or some lower rank emissary from Washington who have traveled to the region with a warning. It is obvious to me that Washington does not want to see the success of the Minsk agreements and overcoming of the crisis in Russian-European relations, although John Kerry constantly reassures me of the contrary. We just have a few minutes, Steve, so I want to go to the focus on that. Sergei Lavrov is saying that the United States wants Minsk II to fail because it would lead to the resolution of the Russian-European problem right now, the sanctions, the Russian-European relations. Does the Secretary of State believe that solving the Russia-Ukraine, Russia-European relations would cut out the United States? Is that what's going on here, Steve? Does the U.S. believe it's being left aside?
I think you left out one thing that Lavrov said, that when he spoke to Kerry, and Kerry said he supported Minsk II, because that's what we're talking about here, and yet Kerry's emissaries, his ambassadors, and lower-ranking members of the State Department and the White House are traveling around encouraging people who are sabotaging Minsk II, Lavrov said Kerry seemed to be detached from reality.
Right.
And that's the difference between a diplomat and a non-diplomat. He's detached from reality. The Russians, and Lavrov is the smartest and most informed and moderate of Russian leaders, are completely baffled by Washington's conduct. But bafflement has given way to a very serious debate, which is, are the Americans uninformed, clumsy, and have slipped into this crisis, or do they have a plan? And increasingly the opinion in Moscow is, and I heard this from one of Putin's fairly high aides when I was there the first week of March, is that opinion grows that Washington, by Washington they mean collective Washington, they're not sure about Obama, has adopted an all-out plan for war by one means or another against Putin's Russia. And that's what this is all about. And therefore, of course, Washington does not want Minsk to succeed, because it would mean the opposite of war with Russia. It would mean negotiations and peace.
Is it that simple? Minsk II success, NATO fail?
If Minsk fails, that means the ceasefire fails.
Right.
If the ceasefire fails, that means the war resumes in the east.
And NATO
wins. American
weapons
go there, and Russia will react to this escalation militarily. And then all bets are off. No one can see beyond that reality.
But the European
that's
capitals...
That's not an opinion, that's a fact.
The European capitals can see this, Steve. We don't need to even speak to Berlin. We can speak to Tsipras, Alexis Tsipras. We can speak to Cyprus and Greece. We can even speak to the president of the Czech Republic. They see this, that means that this breakup of unanimity, what the New York Times characterizes the fragile resolution to continue the sanctions, that means that that's the way to stop it. That's the way to stop the war, to take the sanctions off of Russia.
Or at least while you're waiting for the summer vote on the sanctions, to be sure that Minsk II is implemented politically. But it's not being. I don't know. Do we have 30 seconds
left?
Yes,
we do.
I mean, I think what happened to the European leaders, the EU leaders, when the crisis began, is they were so much in the habit of following the American lead in policy toward Russia. For two reasons. They were doing extremely well in trade with Russia, and the Americans were not involved very much in the trade. The Americans were a lot of hot rhetoric, but they never acted on it. So Europe went along, and then at some point, and we can pretty much date this, early this year, leading up to Merkel's, and I can only call it panicky trip to Minsk to stop this, the European leaders decided that the United States was serious, that this wasn't rhetoric, that they had a warfare attitude toward Russia, and they were going to act on it. So Europe has tried to stop it. And in the stopping, Europe is split, because not all European countries want to stop it. Poland is not in favor of the Minsk agreement, nor are the three small Baltic republics. But generally speaking, we see this unfolding split in Europe. It could be profound and long-lasting. And the United States, though, continues to try to impose its views on this crisis. And that's what Lavrov was saying. I mean, he's talking. He's very close to his European counterparts in the foreign ministries. He lives among them. I mean, Russia's a European country. He's there all the time. He knows what's going on. And basically, by saying publicly, as he did, that Kerry seems detached from reality, he's calling on Europe to rein in the United States.
Professor Stephen F. Cohen, New York University, Princeton University, Russian history. I'm John Batchelor.